you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
In case you didn't know, the IAI have teamed up with Routledge to offer our listeners a 10% discount across their whole range of books. Just follow the link in the podcast description for details.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Philosophy for Our Times, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. In today's podcast, we'll be looking at what makes you, you. Does a narrative of the self exist, and how useful is it for our daily lives?
Well, good morning, and thank you for choosing to come to this debate on the story of I. But did you choose to come today? How much of your decisions really are you, or how much are influenced by a narrative? Who is the I that writes the story of ourselves, and how do we choose the narratives of our lives? Are our choices more like reflexes and decisions all an illusion? Or do we create both who we are and what we want to do? Well, joining me this morning to discuss this fascinating topic, on my right is Mark Salter. Mark is a consultant psychiatrist and author of Outdoor Psychiatry. He spent 2 decades working in acute psychiatric wards. To my left is John Cottingham, professor of philosophy of religion, and to my far left is Richard Morgan. Richard is a science fiction and fantasy author and also writes video games and comics. So starting off with Mark, can you give us your take on this?
Yeah, there's an old ancient Greek saying, we walk backwards into the future. That is to say that we only know where we're going in terms of where we've come from. Our experience and the things that are amass inside our heads, we'll come to what that might mean in a minute, are the things that tell us where we're going to go next. Tories read the Telegraph, Guardian readers read the Guardian. And so we're familiarising ourselves with a framework that's already available to us. Now that's interesting, because automatically it tells us that what we've stored in our heads, memory, is a fundamental part of narrative. Now what is memory? As a doctor who spends a lot of his time looking after people with malfunctioning, not necessarily damaged, but different brains, we realise that memory is fundamentally important to who we think we are, because it's where we store things. But memory isn't a store. Memory is basically a constantly reliving, reinvented thing that is changing all the time. When you remember something, you don't simply retrieve a piece of information. What you do is you revisit the way you remembered it last time and twist it a bit more. Granny's turquoise jumper becomes emerald green. Years later, it's blue. Your favourite perfume is always Chanel, but hang on, this is something different. This is white linen. These things change very, very subtly, not at small levels of perfume and things, but at the levels of belief and ideas. Now, if you actually look at the brain, you'll realise that memory is actually very closest to the ancient, most fundamental, if you like, primeval parts of the brain that are to do with emotion. I want to say something really strange, it might feel odd. Memory is emotion, but with a thing strapped on, and that's language. Because one thing that marks human beings out, uniquely amongst all other creatures on this planet, is their ability to spin words. Birds build nests, humans build sentences. Now, a sentence is an essential way of communicating language to other people, and the purpose of language is just to rub along and create this phenomenal thing called civilization. So for most of the millions of years that we've been separating off from chimpanzees and our other primate cousins, we've come to use this language, but for most of it, as a way of relating to each other. But the narrative, the story I tell about myself, is vulnerable to emotion, and it's also vulnerable to the incredibly complicated world in which we've connected and grown up. Our mothers, our fathers, our families, our myths, our ancestors, our wisdoms, all these shared things that we call culture and value. And for the last 500 years, Western civilization is doing something pretty daft. It's getting lost up its own intellectual backside. The me, the I, has become the focus story. And psychiatry hasn't helped. thanks to Sigmund Freud and a few others, we now see ourselves as these bundles of conflicting, defending processes inside this thing called the ego, struggling at war with the id and some dodgy contract with society and all these kind of things. But we're losing contact with the context of who we used to be and might have been. And that means that as we fall back on language increasingly, the word is standing in for the thing. Because the problem with language is the minute you name something, you're saying what it is, me, I am this person. But the minute I say blue, I'm saying that's not red, green, yellow, indigo. I'm excluding. The choice of a word is a way of narrowing things down. And Western civilization is in danger of narrowing identity into a simple, cheesy story. And hence the tedious replication we seem to see again and again and again. I was abused by my father, that's where I am. Prozac made me a subway bomber. We see these cheesy, stupid simplicities and now served up to us as narrative. Narrative is an emotional thing, and it is at its richest and best when we're constantly shifting and reinventing by having raw emotion. Emotion usually hurts. Think about it, there are five big emotions. Anger, guilt, disgust, shame, sadness, make it six, joy. Five of those are negative. Most of life is about responding to pain and becoming richer. And our narratives are better when we're in that state of emotion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Now I'm going to turn to John Cottingham.
Clearly we change a lot during our lives. And we have different views when we're 70 from the views we had when we were 20 or 40. And obviously we change physically. But I take the kind of traditional view, which goes right back to Aristotle, that despite all the change, there is an enduring subject of change, a substance, if you like, a substrate, the unique I or you that makes you, you, or me, me. And actually, I think biology confirms this, that even a plant or an animal has a unique genetic signature, which gives it identity throughout its life from birth to death. But humans are special. Although we have a lot in common with the rest of the biological realm, we are moral entities. And by that, I mean we have to make decisions during our lives, and we have, hopefully, to improve ourselves. By learning from our many mistakes, we grow ideally into something better. And that process of change, of growth, of moral maturity would, I think, make no sense unless there was some kind of narrative, unless we had a sense of ourselves as coming from a past and moving towards a future which is hopefully better. So that sense of narrative is crucial for the project of maturity and growth, which I think we're all embarked on, whether we fully make it explicit or not. Now, philosophers who write about ethics often, I think, give a very atomistic picture. They focus on isolated actions and decisions. But actually, any meaningful action only takes its place in a fabric which has a past and a future. So to have that sense of narrative story is basic to who we are. Now, who is it that writes that story? Who is this I? Well, I think there are two mistakes. One is the deterministic one of thinking we're just completely programmed by our genes or our upbringing, so there's no real me taking decisions. It's just a rolling out of a determined, causally determined process. That's one mistake. At the other end, there's a mistake of thinking I'm some kind of pure, rational soul, sort of angelic ego that's cut free from the messy world of biology and society. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. We have to acknowledge our biological nature, our social nature, but in virtue of the capacities we inherited via our genes and our upbringing, we have, and we can't get out of it, that unique responsibility for determining the shape of our lives by our decisions. So we have sufficient freedom to be responsible for our actions. Some philosophers have thought there was no real I. David Hume, the 18th century atheist philosopher, thought that there was no true substance or self. And more recently, a lot of philosophers, for example, Sam Harris, one of the new atheists, has talked about the brain being a matter of many different modules or parts. So he thinks the eye is just an illusion. But all this brain science stuff certainly shows there are many elements in the brain, but none of that shows that you are not you, that you don't have that unique sense of yourself as an identical human being over time. So we can't escape our individuality, our freedom, and in a way our duty, our destiny to realize ourselves and to make something of ourselves which shows moral improvement and which moves us towards being better in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a bit of a fraud whenever
I... So that's our narrative.
Thank you.
Because
Richard, last but not least.
Distinguished medical practitioner, you have distinguished philosopher, and then you have a guy who makes shit up for a living. And if you work in creating fiction as I do, one of the things you come to hate over time is Hollywood. And one of the things about Hollywood is its vast idiot simplicity. Its insistence that things must be dumbed down to the level where an 8-year-old child can understand them. And one of the things that you'll very, very often find is with characters is motivation, or motivation, as it's called in Hollywood. The idea that a character does something because of an inciting incident. Something motivates the actions of this character. And I don't know about you, but my life is not like that at all. Generally speaking, I know that I'm on when I'm writing if I can't work out exactly why a character is doing something. I can approximate, I can guess, I can say, yeah, well, it might be because of this aspect of his background, it might be because this has just happened to him, it might be a number of things. And I think the problem really comes down to this issue of simplicity versus complexity. I think there is a drive within humans to make stuff simple, to make life easier, if you like. And it just won't wash. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think the Western way is by far the best. I don't think what we had before Western philosophy and science got started is in any way an alternative, because those are the simplistic narratives. You know, I am who I am because I am a citizen of this city, and if you're a citizen of that city over there, I'm going to kick the shit out of you and murder your children. You know, that those very simplistic narratives are actually what have carried the human race through most of its, what we could call its infancy, and I'd say that post-Enlightenment thought is essentially the next stage. It's where we're going next. But we will need to take along with us a sense of humility and also a sense of inexactitude. And I think we need to get with the program and understand that we are a bit of a mess as far as egos go. Yes, probably the thing we think of as self is an illusion. Most of what I've read on the subject suggests that. It is a kind of floating puddle of illusion that the genetically driven self uses to provide continuity. But so what? You know, I'm fine with that. It's worked for me. I'm 50. It's going okay. This is a process that has millions of years of evolution that has slow engineered it into place, and it does work. Okay, so you can take a certain amount of comfort from that. Yeah? You're riding in a vehicle that's relatively safe. And I think we just have to accept that, yes, it is inexact, it is probably an illusion, but you've got to go with that, accept it. And as we discover more and more, as science probes more and more, that inexactitude will grow. We will become less sure. But you've got to take it with you've got to enjoy it. Bill Hicks, you know, dead comedian who was a great hero of mine back in the day, who said, life is a ride. And I think that's where we come out, certainly where I come out. It's like, yeah, life is a ride. Often doesn't make sense. It's kind of messy. Maybe you are not really you. But yeah, just try and enjoy it.
Richard, thank you. So we're going to explore some of these topics in more detail. Now, throughout the next 30 minutes, we're going to try and answer three quite specific questions. We're going to try and look at what is the I, what is the self that writes these narratives? And secondly, do these narratives help or inhibit our identity? And finally, we're going to look about what we can do. We're going to look forwards, what we can do about this. Are narratives dangerous? How can we avoid them? How can we control them? So starting with our first theme, what is the I? What is it that makes our narratives? Mark, I'm going to put that question to you.
Well, I mean, there can be no doubt about the fact that we exist. You know, I'm not going to get into Descartes or anything right now, but I'm sitting on a chair in a room. I think most of us else are. We can roughly agree on that as reality. But, like I said earlier on, most of our species, you know, have evolved zillions of years with this thing called a brain, within the company of other people and a world and a context. And that context is based not in the laws of human nature, but the laws of physics. stuff happens. You know, and stuff has happened now, it wasn't 5 minutes ago. So time is a very important dimension in which we live our lives, in which you run into people. So stuff happening is what stories are about. Narrative is another word for story. But like I say, it's context, and a very important context for human beings is the human context. And so stories, there's a storyteller and there's a listener. There always is. Otherwise, there's no point in having language. And so the listening thing is changing all the time. But there's still a finite me, driven by my emotions and my values and my drives and all that kind of stuff that makes us go on. And so the story we tell us is a kind of a fudge of the best thing that fits the story now. And it's always up for grabs. I mean, Richard, you said, what was it, that line said, oh, you apologise. Well, I'm just a guy who makes shit up for a living. You know, we need people to make shit up for a living and sell it to us as part of their story. And the world becomes richer, you know. So the eye is an eye struggling to plug into the world. That's what I think.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
So, I'm struggling to... So you believe it's constantly... There isn't... is there anything about the eye which is constant?
I think that's
well, it certainly shouldn't be
reach
filed
for
under
a metaphor
non-fiction.
From a writer I am.
As the stories go.
But I once compare... I wrote a novel in which personality could be transferred from body to body. And I think the idea was that the people had this idea of the self as being this kind of solid structure. And the guy's saying to them, well, it's not really, it's like a sand dune. So it is kind of solid in the fact that you could, yeah, there it is, and you know what a sand dune looks like and so forth. But the point is that over time, influenced by the winds of change or whatever other metaphor you care to reach for, it does shift. It moves around, it changes, and it can actually moves through its landscape as well. So it's neither one nor the other. It is solid to the extent that you can perceive it as solid, but it is still eminently changeable. That is, in all seriousness, that is the best metaphor I've come across for it. Yeah. Yeah.
A sand dune. The self is like a sand dune. I like that idea. John, you would disagree with that.
I think that's overdoing the change. I think the better metaphor would be a tree, or a plant, or any other animal, which we know changes enormously. But we have no problem in saying that's the same tree I planted in my garden 20 years ago. The identity is absolutely indubitable. The other thing is that everyone, the psychiatrist, the author, the philosopher, whoever we are, in evaluating all these issues about how important science is, evolution is, whatever, we're speaking as an answerable, rational self. We couldn't have this discussion
but that
unless
would
we had a sense of ourselves as taking
But the fact so that we do take that seriously...
At that kind of meta level,
I mean, civilization, I think, is the sort of the end result of that. And civilization itself is a bunch of agreed stuff, which is incredibly, in many ways, incredibly fragile. You know, I mean, driving here on these very narrow roads leading into Hay, there's an agreement going on, part of civilization, that I will drive on the left side of the road and that people coming towards me will be on their left, yeah. But it's just an agreement. I mean, there's nothing solid
change.
There. I can cross the white line, with no problem. But it's something we've agreed to. It's Gibson, who's William Gibson, who a great leading light in my profession, and fantastic author. And I mean, he talked about when he invented cyberspace as a concept, he talks about it as a consensual hallucination. And I think that applies pretty much to an awful lot of what we've built as a civilization as well. It is consensual hallucination. So I don't mean to undermine John's point, because it is important, it's massively important, but it doesn't make it any less ephemeral. I think that's the point.
But to just look at lives, I mean, I've spent a lot of my time looking to people whose lives have been shattered, or perhaps some would say enhanced, by changes to their brain, to their lives, horrifying experiences, great experiences. And they're more like the sand dune than they are. You know, if a sand dune could think and use language, it might actually continue to have that sense of constancy. We don't know, obviously. I have no idea what's like to be a sand dune, but what I do know is that, you know, by the end of our lives, we're often radically different from who we were before. Look at our fascination with stories, the return, the revenant, people who come back Oedipus-like, radically transformed. Okay, Telemachus and the dog recognized him, but no one else did. He was transformed out of all recognition. And I'm saying that we are like the sand dunes. So much can happen. When you look at mental illness, which eats at the idea of I, you can go on having a life, even though you believe you're now someone else.
Do you have any good examples, John, of working as a psychiatrist of people that have changed?
Almost of course,
changed?
Yes. Well, can you give gender reassignation. Let's take psychotic illness of a disintegrating chronic sort like schizophrenia or manic depression. People were quite happy with the idea that, you know, they're in different emotional states and therefore with different access to different sorts of memory. The names they give to themselves are very different. Hamlet says, "How stale, weary, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world." He's low. The world he sees, and thus informs who he is distorted by his emotional state. He changes.
But the very word distorted suggests
there's something to be distorted.
Something to be distorted, and that perhaps he could be helped to see things. I mean, it seems to me the very project you're engaged on in trying to help people realize a better self would make no sense unless if everything was just
that's not
a
my
random
project.
Flux.
To be honest, yeah. I don't really give that much interest to creating a better self. I want to create people who have better, happier lives that rub off positively to other people to get us out of the mess that Western civilization appears to be heading towards, because it's a very narrow construction of narrative. You see, coming back to this idea of the sand dune versus the tree, we're at the level of the Cutty Sark. That's got an identity. Every damn bit of wood in that has now been changed. It didn't win the tea.
These aren't living.
That boat
these
now is the
examples we're using here are not living souls. So let's keep these examples to living.
The sand dune and the tree are both.
Does a tree and a sand dune have a soul? That's another debate.
I think the tree's got
Can
a
I,
soul.
Just on this final point, just would like to put this into context. You're a psychiatrist. You obviously see a lot of patients, so you can control maybe with medication, perhaps.
Control isn't the word
I'm not control. Okay.
I'm not writing
change,
their story.
Change, perhaps. Yeah. Change their narratives. Change their perception of themselves. That's a classic example, perhaps, say, of how the self can change. And I would just like to put this to John, who you know you believe the self is constant. What would you say to that? That it, you know, are there cases when the self can change? For example, extreme cases in psychiatry where personalities are changed with drugs.
Of course, I mean, there's no question of denying change. Change, our lives are fluid and always developing. But underlying that change, there is an enduring self that can go wrong, that can get messed up, that can be lost in a mess of emotions, or which can become calmer, more rational, more focused on the things that matter. And we don't write the script. We can't create values. Yeah. We can only pursue things.
I think we can give it a nudge.
We can only pursue things.
Hey, I'm going to go and learn Spanish.
Yes, but
I've never been to Madrid.
But that doesn't Spanish. Make
Okay, let's finish this point and then we're going to move on to the... Okay, but make this very quick and we're going to move on to our next thing.
There are cases, I mean, one that springs to mind immediately, bravery, you know, which we tend to sort of think of a person as brave. But actually that's a very, very ephemeral state. There's a case I was reading about not long ago. Man who, in a wartime context, showed incredible bravery and grit. He was injured in various places, was bleeding out, managed to hold his post and fight off the enemy and all the rest of it. Highly decorated man. He was a sergeant major in the British Army. And he was being treated by a doctor who wrote a book about pain. I can't remember the guy's name, Wall, I think. And he said that 10 years after the war, this guy passed out at the sight of blood. He was just taking blood from him, and he saw it, and it was out cold. And he said, clearly, that man has changed significantly since... No, no, but a man who was capable of
maybe
losing a litre of his own
maybe
blood visibly while killing other men
is
now
bravery
a man who can't
changed.
Stand to have a few drops of blood taken from his arm. It's not... He's mm-hmm. the same man, but obviously he's changed quite radically.
It's not... He's the same man, but obviously he's changed quite radically.
Well, it's a lovely illustration of a convention about narrative. I think he's getting in the way. It's like a trauma.
Oh, I don't think the doctor. I don't think the doctor was saying that it was as a result of the trauma
in the future, or symptoms and consequences that explain it.
Sure. No, but
I'm interested in
trauma as a narrator. Earlier on, you used the phrase in the one sentence. You used psychiatry control. You know, boy, that's a really big re-stereotyping of me. I mean, I think, wow, that's a big narrative to thrust on me. Remember, narratives are stories. Hi, I'm a guy. I'm going to pump drugs into you and control your brain. You know, that's kind of scary. Some of these things we have to accept are, you know, what language does when it tries to impose order on the world.
Richard, I want to ask you one question. You mentioned before one of your books was about the theme of taking a character superimposing their character into another character. What did you have to get your head around?
Well, it's quite interesting
that,
because actually, it's not mine, it's a sort of hoary old science fiction trope, the idea of digitizing is a modern way of looking at it, but taking the mind, abstracting it, and then re-implanting it somewhere else. I mean, I think it first showed up in a Star Trek episode in 1950-something. It's been in science fiction since forever. Interestingly enough, if you go back to the 50s, it was seen in terms almost of a soul, basically. The digital concept is Gibson's. That came along with cyberpunk and the understanding of digital science. And it was a new metaphor, if you like, for understanding it. But the funny thing is, the story I ended up telling, which is a sort of rather bloody neo-noir type narrative, was actually triggered by talking to a Buddhist. Because we were arguing about whether you're responsible for things you've done that you can't remember, because Buddhism, at least the Buddhism that this guy practiced, says that if you're suffering in this life, it's because you did something in a previous life that you've now got to pay for. And my response to that was, fuck off. And the book was really based upon that, the idea of can you punish people for things they can't remember doing. Well, this is the problem, isn't it? It really is.
So would you punish a Nazi war criminal with
Alzheimer's? A friend of mine up at Glasgow Uni, Colin Gavahan, who's invented a job for himself, because he's actually a lawyer by trade, but he got in early on the bioethics train, and he now basically lectures in the legal ramifications of where we're going with biotech. And Alzheimer's is one of his, because he says, you could make a will in which you wish to be euthanized at the point where your Alzheimer's self can no longer do whatever X number of things that you choose. He said, the problem is, by the time that happens to you, the question is that self the same person who wrote the will? And if it's not, then how dare you try and impose the will of this other person onto this? And he said, because the guy who's got the Alzheimer's, he might actually be relatively happy. You know? Yeah.
Yes. I tell you, Terry Pratchett found an interesting way out of that. Was to adopt a co-writer,
right,
someone whom he trusted utterly to help him, first with the typing, then with ideas, then with abstraction. So in a sense, he deferred
his
Pratchettness. It took up location in another mind, in a sense.
Just finally, John, what do you say to that?
The question of responsibility for past actions.
Yes, and if you can't remember, or if you are some way socially not responsible for it.
The whole issue of personal identity is enormously complicated, but often it's used as a way of evading responsibility for what we do here and now. And our freedom now, if you pass someone in the street asking for money, you know absolutely that you are free either to give the money or to walk past. There is no getting away from that fundamental inner knowledge we have of our own freedom. We're not necessarily responsible for things in early childhood, things we've forgotten. There are all sorts of problems about over time and the future self and so on. But nonetheless, at the present moment, we have a responsibility to exercise our freedom. That's all we're answerable for.
Although the narratives now available to us through chemistry, for example, can blur that. Prozac made me a subway bomber, These ideas that ourselves are being changed by, so-called cosmetic psychopharmacology. Lipstick changes the appearance of those who wear it, so does Prozac. It's a very strange thing.
Okay, thank you. Now, I'd like you all to thank Mark Salter, John Cottingham, Richard Morgan.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast, which was brought to you by the Institute of Arts and Ideas. So what do you think? Is the narrative of the self just a useful tool, or is it a genuine component of what makes us unique? Let us know by tweeting at IAI_TV with the hashtag Philosophy for Our Times.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.